It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in our Curious Wisconsin segment today, we'll look at the contributions of Eau Claire and Western Wisconsin to Major League Baseball and talk about how one of the greatest players of all time got his start in the Chippewa Valley.
First, State School Superintendent Tony Evers just announced the formation of a task force charged with recommending solutions to the racial achievement gap in the Milwaukee area and across the state.
The announcement comes months after a national assessment that showed that the gap between black and white students in Wisconsin was the widest in the nation, and days after a report that ranked the state as the worst in the nation for African-American children.
The task force is being led by Damon Means, superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District, and he joins us now to talk about what he hopes to accomplish. Damon, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, as we said, you're heading up this new task force to help close the achievement gap. It seems like starting with Milwaukee and then extrapolating out to the rest of the state. Why is this the right time for a task force like this?
I think it's the right time because we have known as educators in the state of Wisconsin that children of color, not only African-American students, but Hispanic students, have ranked near the bottom when you look at the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP results. And as a state, we continue to talk about increasing job opportunities and making our state more appealing from an economic standpoint. If we are ignoring the educational pursuits of children of color in our state, then we are failing our children, but more importantly, we're failing to prepare Wisconsin for the future.
It seems like there's been a lot of bad news about student achievement and racial disparities in schools in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee this year alone. When you get together with other educators, what do you think about this? What do you say to each other about it?
What we say is that we have to do a much better job than what we're currently doing collectively. And I think the other issue that we're really excited to tackle, State Superintendent Tony Evers and I, we're excited to tackle the issue of perception with this task force. When you talk about the fact that there are children of color who are underperforming in our state, typically people will turn their attention to Milwaukee or Racine or Madison, all the urban areas of our state. But when you see the migration of families of color in our state, people are living in non-urban areas now, so it's not unusual for families of color to live in areas like Toma or Superior. And so this is a statewide issue. It's not a Milwaukee issue or an urban issue, but it's truly an issue that we all need to get our arms wrapped around if we're going to make Wisconsin a brighter place for the next generation.
Have you gotten far enough along to know what your major goals are?
Yes, we do have three major goals. The first is to examine and recommend proactive instructional strategies to close the gaps among our children in Wisconsin. The second is to develop a resource for Wisconsin teachers, principals, school board members to use as they're working towards closing the achievement gaps. And then finally, some governance suggestions for school board members as they work towards closing the achievement gaps as well. So we want to hit all three levels. We want to hit the classroom level, clearly, but also school-wide strategies. And then finally, some strategies that school board members can utilize in their role as governance leaders.
And what can you tell us about the makeup of the task force? Who are the other people joining you in this?
Sure. We have a really exciting group that we're bringing together, and we're really excited about who will be working with us. We took a look at schools across our state who are demonstrating work and progress in closing the achievement gaps. We have teachers from Fond du Lac, Beloit, the Madison Metropolitan School District, West Allis, West Milwaukee, Janesville, the Menominee Indian School District, Oshkosh, Wausau. We also have educators from Racine and Sun Prairie and Green Bay. But we're also working with our charter and voucher colleagues as well. So there will be members from that community and that school community as well, Notre Dame Middle School and St. Marcus and other places as well. I think we have a very diverse group of educators who will come to the table and help us address this issue. But Dr. Evers, State Superintendent Evers, had a vision that he wanted to ensure that the task force was mainly comprised of teachers, people who are working in schools and who are achieving great success in closing the gaps. And I think that's the most exciting element of this task force.
Now, there are education pundits, Diane Ravitch is one, who say that you'll never close the achievement gap until you tackle poverty. Do you imagine looking at issues like that that extend beyond school walls, or will it stay strictly within the school?
Well, I think we're going to have to look at some elements of poverty and how poverty impacts children and their learning. But I think ultimately what we want to focus our primary attention to is what can we do once the children come to the schoolhouse door? What can we provide as an educational institution or an organization once those children come to our schools? And that's going to be our primary focus. As a side note, I serve on a committee, our group is called the Social Development Commission in the city of Milwaukee. We, with the SDC group, we're actually looking at the poverty issue closer than what this task force that Tony Evers has put together. And so I guess the walk that I will be involved in the next few months will clearly address not only the instructional side of things, which is the DPI task force, but I will also be working with our SDC task force on looking at poverty and how it impacts children as well.
And you're not just dealing with the divide between black students and white students. There are other racial gaps you'd like to address as well.
Absolutely. As the NAEP score showed, our Hispanic students are underperforming in our state, but I'm also concerned about subgroups like our economically disadvantaged students. I'm concerned about our special needs students. There are a lot of subgroups in our state who are underperforming when you look at their test scores. But it goes beyond test scores, I think. I think this also has to do with the type of connections that these young people feel that they have with their local schools. And typically, when a child feels connected to the school that they attend, they perform better. And so not only do we want to address the gaps that we see from standardized test scores, but we also want to make sure that our schools are welcoming places for all subgroups, regardless of the location of the school.
Now, closer to home for you, what approaches have you used in the Mequon-Thiensville district to try and close the racial achievement gap?
We have we've used a few different strategies. I think the one that we're most proud of is that we established a teacher-led group called the District Equity Leadership Team. And so it's a team of teachers, but there's also some principals on the team that look at our data. They lead professional development opportunities for our teachers inside the district. They teach our teaching force how to be more culturally competent. And so we felt that it was crucial to make sure that our teacher leaders were leading the charge in delivering the message around cultural competency. Anytime that something like this is top down and administrators are telling teachers that this is what you should do, it never works. Teachers respect one another. They respect other teachers. And so we felt that developing our district equity leadership team was something that was very important. It may sound small, but another strategy that we've used is that we've started talking about the racial gaps in terms of student performance very candidly and frankly and openly. Typically, educators are uncomfortable in talking about racial issues and racial performance of subgroups. And so what we've done in our school district, we've made it safe to talk about these issues and to address them with strategies. The last thing I would say that we've done is we've continued to try to make our school communities a welcoming place for all students, regardless of the subgroup that they belong to. Those are three very tangible strategies that we've utilized in Mequon-Thiensville. And if you look at our state report card that's issued by a DPI, we do very well in closing gaps based on that objective metric.
Damon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and we appreciate you following our work.
Simon Means is the superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District. He was just chosen to lead a task force to address the racial achievement gap for students in the Milwaukee area.
It might not feel like spring outside, but it is. And for sports fans, that means one thing: baseball season is back. Major League Baseball kicked off its 2014 season this week, and while the Brewers might not be off to the hottest of starts, it's hard not to feel optimistic about a new and still wide-open season.
But it's also fun to look back at some of Wisconsin's baseball history. And it turns out that for many years, the Chippewa Valley was a hotbed of promising young baseball players. Some of them would go on to be household names. In this week's Curious Wisconsin, we look at Western Wisconsin's baseball heritage and learn more about some of the greats who played ball in Eau Claire.
Joining us now is Jerry Poling. He's Assistant Director of Communications at UW-Stout and the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess for a lot of years, Eau Claire was home to a team initially called the Bears, then the Braves. What can you tell us about the team?
The Bears and the Braves played in Eau Claire Class C minor league ball from 1933 through 1962 and had some of the better teams in the Northern League throughout those years. And the Northern League consisted of teams Superior, Wausau, Fargo, Duluth, St. Cloud. It was a highly regarded Class C minor league, and Eau Claire won several pennants throughout that time and developed a number of really well-known players. And there were also a number of great players, obviously, who came through Eau Claire playing for teams throughout that league.
So how did Eau Claire, this place in northwest Wisconsin, end up having this hotshot baseball team?
Well, Eau Claire's baseball history, much like many communities in Wisconsin, goes back to the 1870s, 1880s. We had town teams here in Eau Claire for, you know, throughout the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then the minor league team just happened to develop in 1933, and eventually became affiliated with the Boston Braves, and then the Milwaukee Braves in Milwaukee when the Braves moved to Milwaukee in 1953. I think part of it was the town tradition, great town teams over the years, and some good players who came out of there, including one player in the Baseball Hall of Fame named Burley Grimes. Considered the last spitballer in Major League Baseball, played against Babe Ruth. He played his first minor league season, even though it wasn't professional minor leagues, in Eau Claire in 1912, I believe it was. So there's a real long history of solid town and semi-pro baseball in Eau Claire before the minor league professional teams actually came to town.
We'll name some more names in a minute, but this Northern League that the Eau Claire team was part of, was it a big minor league for people who went on to the majors? Did we get a lot of names out of there?
Yeah, there were some outstanding players who came through. Even though it was considered Class C ball, it was considered by today's standards probably closer to like a double A, because there were just a lot more minor league teams Major League teams had more minor league teams back then. So there was just and baseball was the sport and kind of the only really big sport back in the early 1900s, unlike professional football today. So any great athlete who came out of high school or college, he probably wanted to play professional baseball. So the competition at the pro minor league level was just incredibly tough. So there were lots of great minor league teams. And, some of the players who came out of there, in addition to, I'll mention maybe in a bit some of the Eau Claire guys, but Roger Maris, who broke Babe Ruth's record for home runs in one season, came out of Fargo in the Northern League. Lou Brock played at St. Cloud. Joe Pepitone played in the league. He was a future star for the New York Yankees. Don Larson, who threw the no-hitter in the World Series for the New York Yankees, came out of the Northern League. You could go through dozens and dozens of really fine players who came out of that league. And, of course, Eau Claire having Hank Aaron was a prime example of some of the talent that was in that league from 40s, 50s, 60s. And then the Northern League kind of died out in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and let's go back to Hank Aaron now. That's a huge name to come out of the league in Eau Claire. How did he first end up there?
Well, he got signed by, he was playing for the Indianapolis Clowns and got noticed by some of the scouts and got signed by the Boston Braves. And they assigned him to come to Eau Claire because it was considered a good starting point for a young player like that who had no professional experience other than just a spring with the Indianapolis Clowns. So it was really an interesting experience for Henry because he had grown up playing only with other black players in the South and on the Indianapolis Clowns team. So had never really been in an unsegregated area, really traveling with the clowns or growing up. And then he lands in Eau Claire, this northern city that has really only, I think, one or two other black people in town at the time. He'd never been that far north in his life, had never, you know, played against a white player, had never batted against a white player. It was a completely new experience for him culturally. And then, of course, just the minor league part of it as well was he was playing professional, organized, highly organized baseball for the first time.
Do we know anything about what Hank Aaron thought about, this town where he was one of, you said, two or three black people in an all-white, otherwise all-white community?
Yeah, it was, he would probably tell you that it was very uncomfortable for him at first. He just felt out of place. There were two other black players on the team that year, and one of them was Wes Covington, who went on to play for the Milwaukee Braves. But he was a shy person, he would say, and he was only 18 at the time. And when he got here, he didn't really know, you know, where he could go safely, what he could do, you know, with the segregation in the South. He was very careful about what he did. But so I think the first month was a real challenge for him, just trying to adjust to a community that was totally, totally different culturally than where he'd grown up. But then once he kind of settled in and realized the people were nice, they were going to treat him fair, and that he was actually playing well on the field and he could hit.
Yeah, what was that season like? Was he a breakaway star right away?
Pretty much. I mean, he was one of the guys that was considered to be potentially a phenom, kind of like a Willie Mays. And the Milwaukee Braves and Boston Braves scouts, actually we've been Boston Braves that year, what they would call Eau Claire every day to see how he was doing. And one of their messages was, because Hank was considered such a naturally great hitter, they said, whatever you do, don't mess with his swing. Just let him hit the way he naturally hits. So, yeah, he ended up being Rookie of the Year in the Northern League. He hit .336, made the All-Star team after being in town for a little over a month, about a month and a half. He was an eye-opener in terms of his hitting ability. He only hit 9 home runs that year, so he wasn't showing the type of ability where you would say, he's going to break Babe Ruth's home run record someday. No, he was 155 pounds soaking wet at that time. pretty not filled out, really, and wasn't a home run hitter, but an incredibly great contact hitter already. You know, he only struck out, I think it was 13 times or something the whole summer. It was just amazing. You know, he just got the bat on the ball all the time.
Do people in Eau Claire have any memory about what he was like just as a person?
Yeah, you know, people said he was shy, like, and he said that himself. He was quite shy about his surroundings, and there was a young woman that he became friends with that summer, and she would say, you know, she had to make jokes and kind of like engage him because he just wouldn't say a whole lot. He was just kind of a quiet young man and still adjusting to a different environment. Everybody said, though, that he was just a nice young man, really, you know, really friendly when you got a chance to talk to him, very hardworking on the field. His teammates loved him. You know, he was just a great player. So, yeah, I think it was really, you know, when I wrote on this book, when I got done with the book, it kind of dawned on me that really I think this was kind of that seminal summer in his life where, you know, he went from boyhood to manhood, being away from home that far away for the first time, and really getting a chance to see if he could make it on his own and make it in a strange environment. And I think it kind of steeled him for some of the challenges he would face later in his life when he was breaking Babe Ruth's home run record in terms of, can I handle a difficult situation? And I think he came out of that season saying, I can play baseball in the major leagues. I can handle things on my own. I'm on my way.
So why is the Eau Claire team, the Bears or Braves, no longer with us?
Well, most minor league teams started to falter in the early 1960s when baseball started to expand and something known as television started to become very popular in people's homes and people could watch baseball on TV all of a sudden. And minor league teams' attendance dropped precipitously in the early 1960s, and that was what happened in Eau Claire, just like many other cities. The attendance really kind of the bottom fell out of attendance for minor league baseball. In Eau Claire especially, there was prior to the 1960s, there was the only place to go see a pro baseball game was the Chicago Cubs. And all of a sudden in the 1960s, now in the 50s, you've got the Milwaukee Braves a few hours away, and you've got the Minnesota Twins now an hour and a half away or 2 hours away. So that ate into attendance as well. So it really became a money thing. The major league team didn't have enough to support all of the minor league teams, they started cutting back, and then you had fewer fans going to the games. So minor league baseball kind of dried up in a lot of towns.
Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was great being on your show.
That's Jerry Poling. He's the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out why we all seem to be overwhelmed in our day-to-day lives and how we can work, love, and play when we don't have the time.
The Wisconsin Film Festival began today. We'll talk with a UW grad and director of one of the films playing at the film festival this weekend.
And we'll be joined by our news guy Noah Ofshinsky, who'll drop by to round up the state news stories of the week.
That and more coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. The rise of the machines and the end of the human era has been a theme of science fiction books and movies over the years, including the movie Terminator. That's the theme song we're listening to now.
But our next guest says that those science fiction fears have the potential to become reality as artificial intelligence gets better and better.
James Barrett joins us now. He's a documentary filmmaker. His new book is Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, what's the current state of the art? What kind of more or less autonomously operating computers are already working on a daily basis?
Well, we've got pretty advanced cognitive architectures like Watson. You know, this year Watson is studying to pass the federal medical licensing exam. Watson is going to be taking on law pretty soon and doing legal research. It's already doing pharmaceutical research. And that's just the beginning. You know, a whole new species was born with Watson, and that's called cognitive machines, thinking machines. And they'll think like we do. They think in parallel, not serially. They're massive parallel processing machines, and it's going to go forward from there. We don't have anything that approaches human level intelligence or general intelligence, but that's on the drawing board for a lot of companies.
And Watson's the one that did so well on Jeopardy, right?
Yeah, Watson defeated the two champions at Jeopardy, and Jeopardy is not a trivial game. It involves, word understanding, puns, a vast store of knowledge. You know, Watson had 200 million pages of information at its disposal, and it showed us what in that narrow game, what AI can do.
And you mentioned computers aren't at human-level intelligence yet, but people talk about the idea of an intelligence explosion, something that, they could quickly get to our level and beyond. How close are we to that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, for my book, Our Final Invention, I talked to a lot of AI researchers, and the mean date for when that'll happen is about 2045. Ray Kurzweil, who's very optimistic about the technological singularity, which you're referring to, thinks about 2029. We have to keep in mind there's a lot of companies that are pouring billions of dollars into creating what's called AGI, Artificial General Intelligence, or human-level intelligence. Those companies include Google, IBM, companies like Vicarious, DeepMind, which was just bought by Google, and agencies like DARPA, like the NSA, countries like China and Israel. For them, human-level intelligence is really job number one. And then once we're near human level intelligence, whether that's 20 years from now or 80 years from now, we have to keep in mind we've created machines already that are better than us at chess, Jeopardy, navigation, search, theorem proving, and more. And probably within the next decade or two, we'll create machines that are better at AI research than we are. At that point, they'll be able to improve their own capabilities very quickly. And these machines will jump from roughly human-level intelligence to vastly superhuman intelligence. And that's the intelligence explosion, when machines become self-aware and self-improving.
Well, you just listed a bunch of ways in which fairly intelligent machines are useful to us, but why something that becomes super intelligent, why would it end up being hazardous to us?
Well, Gary Marcus, who's a psychologist and neuroscientist, wrote a review of Our Final Invention in The New Yorker, and he said, it's not so much when it happens, whether it's whether we create super intelligence in 20 years or in 100 years, it's what happens next. That is, are we prepared for it? Now, we're going to have a really difficult time governing super intelligence because, as a lot of AI theorists propose, it will have drives much like our own, drives like self-protection and resource acquisition. For any goals it has, it will need resources. And then it will come in conflict with us, because those are the same resources we'll need.
Well, can't we just program from the outset these artificial intelligences with safeguards? Something like you mentioned in the book, Isaac Asimov's Three Rules of Robotics, that wouldn't allow them to do us any harm.
Yeah. Well, you know, Asimov created those rules, as I say, I think in Chapter 1, to create tension and fiction. He created them to generate stories. He himself admitted that. They're not very good in the real world. For example, just the definition of life. You and I may agree on when life begins, but a whole lot of people will not agree with us on when life begins. In some parts of the world, what is human doesn't include women or children. Values are values that we would have to program into a machine, change from culture to culture, and they change over time. We wouldn't want to embrace Roman ethics, you know, togas, you know, orgies, slavery, and we wouldn't want people 1,000 years from now to embrace our values necessarily. So we'd have to program into this machine this kind of intuition and value judgment that we ourselves aren't really very good at. So that's really the crux of the issue. When we're creating super intelligent machines, we'll come to a point where they'll have to anticipate what our goals and what our values are, and that's extremely hard to even for theorists to consider.
And you worry that values, goals, morals, ethics wouldn't really be part of the equation at all. A self-aware artificial intelligence would be interested, like a form of life, in survival and maybe propagation of itself.
Well, you know, we steer the future as humans not because we're the strongest or the fastest creature on the planet, but because we're the smartest. You can bet that once machines are smarter than we are, they'll be steering the future. We can't constrain a superintelligence indefinitely. So we'll have to count on them being ethical and moral. And those are concepts that we have, you know, we have very little experience programming into machines. And meanwhile, while some people, and I want to mention MIRI, which is the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, they're working on creating friendly AI now, way before it gets to the stage of human-level intelligence. But while some people are worried about friendly AI and programming ethics into a computer, there's a giant rush to create autonomous battlefield robots and autonomous drones. And to be very clear, these are machines that kill humans without humans in the loop. So we've got, you know, a lot of money going into creating really, really violent machines and very, very little money going into creating artificial intelligence that's reliably and predictably safe.
We're talking to James Barrett about his new book, Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era.
And you can join the conversation with your questions and your thoughts. Is this something that keeps you up at night, or do you not buy the argument that artificial intelligence could be a threat? Call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation about artificial intelligence and its potential threat to humanity with James Barrett, author of Our Final Invention.
And you can join in. Do you think he makes a convincing case that we should worry about potential threats from artificial intelligence? Are you worried based on what you've heard? What would you like to see change as far as how research is done and regulated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. James, what are you hoping we do with these worries you bring up? Would you like to see us stop researching artificial intelligence?
No, not at all. You know, contrary to my book's title, I really like AI. I really like robotics. And I became sort of deeply involved in the conversation with them because I like them. There are a number of things we can do. There was when scientists were worried about recombinant DNA, they all got together and they stopped research and got together in Asilomar Conference Center in California and came up with basic guidelines like don't track the DNA out on your shoes into the environment. It might contaminate it. Advanced AI needs an Asilomar conference, needs to get people together to talk about guidelines and set up some rules. Something very encouraging just happened when Google bought an AI startup called DeepMind. The founders of DeepMind insisted that a condition of the sale be that Google set up a board of standards and safety, ethics and safety, for the use of their technology. So they were acknowledging that that AI is a dual-use technology capable of great good and great harm, and they're also setting the bar quite high for future acquisitions in AI research.
That's one company, though. There are other companies doing this, governments, presumably. You mentioned, I think, the possible criminal applications of artificial intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
How encouraging is it that this one instance is providing this example?
It's extremely encouraging. To hold up a $400 million sale on this condition of creating a safety and ethics board is really, really important. We have to take that message to the government. You know, the NSA couldn't have done their deep data mining without high-level data mining software, and that's AI. So we can see how, you know, the government's got a foot in both camps. They want to weaponize AI. They want to use AI for surveillance. But it's in their interest to make sure that AI is safe from here out.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Joe on the line in Madison. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I see, I'd like to hear your guest's perspective on the Internet of Things. I see the concept of embedding a computer chip in everything to allow everything to talk to each other about its, you know, position in relation to other things as another step in the effort of intelligence, artificial intelligence.
Joe, thanks for the call. The Internet of Things, among other things, you know, our refrigerator will know when to order milk and maybe have it delivered, I don't know, by a drone somewhere down the road. How does that fit into this?
Well, that's a great question, Joe, and it's a great observation. What it means is that we surrender, I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but it means we surrender more of our privacy and more of our autonomy. Now, your refrigerator might know when you want more milk, but so does the people that manufacture the refrigerator and the people that manufacture the milk. So, and that's what's driving the Internet of Things. You know, we get a lot of convenience and a lot of cool tools with advanced AI and with the Internet of Things, but we also lose more and more of our privacy. There's software that tracks us everywhere we go. There's software that targets us for advertisements. What is our zone of privacy? AI is a hugely powerful tool being used by the manufacturers, not being used by the people to secure their own interests. So the Internet of Things to me sounds like more Big Brother.
Joe, thanks for the call. Another caller who couldn't stay on the line suggested that we program these computers to love all life as an effort to try to save humanity. So put life at the center of our artificial intelligence, I guess, James.
And that's he's put his finger on the issue with programming ethics into a computer. If he loves all life, then it loves Streptococcus bacteria as much as it loves human life. You know, right there, that's an Asimovian paradox where you've got conflicting rules already. And that's the dilemma, to create ethics in a machine that come out positive for humanity and not negative.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Dennis on the line in Milwaukee. Dennis, hi. Dennis, are you there? We have no Dennis. How about Joanne in Milwaukee? Let's give her a shot. Joanne, hi. I wonder if the machines have taken over the phone lines. Joanne, are you there?
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, I knew this was going to happen. They're trying to shut down our conversation.
Yeah.
Well,
hello?
Joanne,
hello.
There you are. Hi. What is your question?
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. Just a little while ago, I was on my computer and was told that it had to have an upgrade from Windows XP. So I clicked around and got this group that said they were going to do it for me, and I gave them some information, and suddenly they took control of my computer. And their little mouse was wandering around across my screen. And I got to thinking, wait a minute, I've just given over control to my computer. What else will happen if those sort of things happen?
Joanne, thanks for the call. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a human on the other end. There's a lot of automatic updates where software elsewhere on the internet, checks out your computer, says, oh, you're due for the update, and loads it automatically, James.
Well, you know, there's a little item called Terms of Service that you click on and you accept. And Terms of Service is way too weak a tool for us to permit access to all the details of our life. As Joanne just said, she just gave everyone access to her computer, gave an upgrade service and access to her computer. Their ends were probably not nefarious, but there's plenty of malware out there, some of it created by, you know, by our own government and malware experts all over the world that do want the details. They want to go in, they want to take your credit card information, and they want to commit identity theft and fraud. So we have to be very careful with that, with handing over the keys to our computer to anyone.
Thanks for the call. We've got Leah in Green Bay on the line now. Leah, hi.
Hi. Well, to me, you need a multi-seminar conference on the question of the ethics and the social implications of having a society where everything is artificial intelligence and you have no work for people.
Yeah.
Because that's the direction we're going in. If gradually computers and robots take over the work and they get smarter, what will people do? How will they live? How will they earn a living?
Thanks for the call, Leah. A lot there, the social implications and maybe humans redundant if the machines are doing everything anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a whole great conversation there. You know, MIT came out with a report recently that said within a couple of decades, I think it was 50% of all jobs can be automated, and a lot of them will. You know, AI and automation are encroaching into our jobs, and we don't have a real clear plan for how to deal with it. One of the reasons I wrote Our Final Invention was just to get the dangerous AI dilemma into the public conversation. And there's already and needs to be a conversation about, you know, are we willing to trade convenience for jobs? Are we willing to trade automation for jobs? It absolutely benefits the people who own the factories, but what about us? What about the rest of us? Is this the future we want?
Are you seeing yourself as a lone voice crying in the wilderness here, or as you research this, did you come across people in the worlds of science, research, security who are having similar worries?
Yes. In fact, I think the AI researchers are the people who are most excited about the book. And these aren't my ideas. These are ideas I got from interviewing people who are working in AI. And they all see this future in which, superintelligence is coming. And the question, as Gary Marcus wrote in the New Yorker, the question is, what happens after? Are we prepared for it? You know, we're doing a lot of really fast product development in AI and automation, but we're not doing a lot of basic research. And so we're getting things, and we'll get things that are extremely intelligent, but not very much like us. And we'll get a lot of machines that are displacing us in our work. So we have to start a conversation now, and we have to set up guidelines, or we'll lose the ability to have any choice.
James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was James Barrett. His new book is Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era.